Good morning. You are listening to Upfront. I am Kat Brooks. In 2011, a United Nations expert on torture called on all countries to ban the solitary confinement of prisoners except in very exceptional circumstances and for as short as time as possible, with an absolute prohibition in the case of juveniles and people with mental disabilities. Our guest today, Albert Woodfox, would remain in solitary confinement for another 5 years before finally being released after spending 40 years in solitary confinement, mostly at Angola Prison in Louisiana. He has written a book about his experience called Solitary, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, sir. Thank you so much for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
And first, I want to say I'm glad you're home. And
thank you.
Yes, sir. Free them all. Before we get into Angola and your time there, I want to go back to your childhood, just like you started in the book, and talk a little bit about what growing up was like for you.
Well, it was, you know, growing up being African-American was a very difficult, even now, you know, but it was more, I guess you could say society was a little more brutal in its application of racism in America, and in particular in New Orleans, Louisiana. The N-word was used so often that, you know, there was a point in time when I expected to be addressed by that word rather than my name. Opportunities were non-existent. It was just a difficult life, you know. My mom was a single parent after 20-something years of marriage. You know, she did the best she could, which I thought was, you know, in hindsight, was marvelous. You know, although we lived in poverty, we never felt as though we were, you know.
Mm-hmm. And at some point in your life, you decided you were going to hit the streets and make your own money. What led you to that decision? You can talk about those early days running the streets as a young Albert Woodfox.
Well, what led me, you know, it wasn't a conscious decision. It was a way of life for African-American men in the 60s. You know, as I say, opportunities were almost non-existent. And, you know, survival is the strongest instinct in humanity. And so, you know, in order to survive, you know, if you couldn't get a regular job or a well-paying job, the only opportunity left was the crime life or the hustle or the game, as it was referred to. And so it was almost like a rite of passage, you know, for young African-American males during that time.
And at what point, when was the first time you got in real trouble with the law? With police?
Well, any time during the, you know, the 60s when racism was at the height of brutality in America, any time that African-American males had any kind of encounter with the law, it was serious. But my first time being arrested was, there was a hustle. It was called parking cars, you know. We lived in a close proximity to the municipal auditorium, which is where most of the events were held in New Orleans. And once, you know, we would park cars with promises to the people to watch their cars while they were attending these events. And, of course, it was, you know, considered illegal by police departments. And so I was arrested for parking cars. So that was the very first time I was arrested by the New Orleans Police Department. But prior to that, I had encounters with them. I had been stopped and frisked, and, you know, the N-word was used constantly and while talking to me or giving me orders and stuff, which, you know, wasn't unique to me. As I say, during those times, that was the way of life that I experienced.
And I imagine, I mean, similar to today, but more legal in the 60s, just any engagement with law enforcement could be the end of your life.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, my experience during those times, you know, the, what we used to call a beat down, you know, you could, you know, be slapped upside the head or shoved up against the wall, forcibly make, forced to lean on the wall and spread your legs, in which they would kick each one of your legs, you know, tell you, open your legs wider. It was more like that type of police brutality than, you know, being, you know, shot as it is today. You know, I don't know if it was a culture thing or whatever, but you know, you worried more about the beatdown than being shot.
Let's talk about how you ended up at Angola. What were the circumstances the first time that led up to that?
Well, the first time I went to Angola was for car theft, which was another form of hustle. You know, you stole cars and you sold them to fences, usually someone who owned used car lots. So, you know, I got busted for car theft, and I wound up being sentenced to 2 years in Angola. That was my first time. I did 8 months, made parole. I got out, got arrested. I don't know, after about 6 months, my parole was violated. And I was sent back to Angola. I did another 8 months, and then I was released on what's called good time. At that time, you were getting something like 2 days for everyone.
And then, so I want to talk about a little bit. So before you got to Angola, I imagine you had heard of Angola and what it was like there.
Oh, yeah. Everybody knew what Angola was, you know. I mean, it's sad, but it was almost like, you know, a badge of honor if you went to Angola and you survived it, you know. I mean, Angola was such a bloody and brutal prison at the time. And so many black prisoners were being killed on a regular basis. So, you know, to be sentenced to Angola and to survive and come back into society was almost, like I say, legendary, you know.
How old were you the first time you went to Angola?
About 18, I think. I just turned 18.
You was a baby. So paint a picture for us. What was it like when the bus rolled in? Do you remember that moment? What did you see and hear? Were you scared? What was that moment like when it became reality?
I was scared. Well, yeah, I mean, I was scared to death. This was a first-time experience, you know. Even now, in Angola, there's a big white building at the front gate, and it's called RC, which means reception center. So when you processed into the prison, you stayed in that building for approximately 30 days, and they would run you through, you know, the various processes, examined by a doctor, aptitude tests, you know, psychiatric talks, you know, which asking your name, where you was born, and, you know, stuff along that line. And being assigned to a certain area of the prison, Angola's 18,000 agriculture prison, former slave plantation. It consists of various what's called outer camps, and there is a main prison complex. And so, you know, while you are in RC, the staff there would assign you to a certain living area and a job assignment, which usually meant field hand.
So, okay, so you went to Angola twice. When did you go back and that began the 40-year stretch? What did you go back for?
I was busted for armed robbery in 1969. And was tried and convicted and sentenced to 50 years. I escaped the same day that I was sentenced, and eventually I wound up in Harlem, New York, because I was familiar with Harlem from, you know, the days when I was in the crime game. And so, you know, but this was a different Harlem than it was when I had, you know, been to Harlem previously. And it was my first up-close and personal encounter with the Black Panther Party members. And I guess you could say that was the first step on the journey the rest of my life.
What about the Panthers intrigued you?
The fearlessness. You know, all my life, I had always sensed in black people a fear that was always below the surface, you know, because we know we had no control over our lives. We had no power to protect ourselves. And that we were totally at the mercy, particularly of the police who patrol our neighborhoods. And, but, you know, this, for the first time, you know, I saw these young black men and women who were fearless, you know. I didn't sense that sense of fearless or fear, you know. I could sense a, you know, pride, a purpose, direction, discipline, you know. And when I did see some fear, and it was so strange, it was, I noticed the cops who were patrolling Harlem at the time. And, you know, you could sense that they would rather be anywhere else but in Harlem, you know, because of the challenges of the Black Panther Party, the police brutality and raising the level of consciousness of the people in the community, letting them know that, you know, they had the right to be treated in a more humane way when they did encounter the police.
So you're in Harlem, and how long are you on the run in Harlem before you get caught?
Oh, a couple of weeks. Actually, what happened is, you know, I was still in that stage of being a petty criminal. So I placed the bookie, you know, I placed a bet with a bookie on a football game, and I won a pretty large sum of money. But when I went there, he sensed that I wasn't from Harlem because of my accent or whatever, you know, lack of experience or whatever. And so instead of paying me my money, they jumped me and beat me pretty bad, and then they called police and said I tried to rob them. It was a store, a corner store in Harlem. And for, you know, I went to trial and was found not guilty because both of the men had a extensive police record of you know, running numbers and attacks, assault charges and stuff like that. So the jury found me not guilty once what really happened came out. And the attorney was successful in cross-examining the two guys, two main witnesses, and showing them to be liars and the contradiction in what they say happened.
So that ended you back up inside. And then at what point did you... Well, actually, I want to stay in New York for a little while because that was, I believe, your first encounter with people that were locked up revolting against the conditions that they were experiencing.
Yeah, you know, I was in what's called the Tombs. It's the Manhattan House of Detention. And, you know, you would never guess that it was a prison, a city jail. You know, it just looked like any other high-rise building in New York. And during my time there, the Panther 21 occurred, in which there was an attack by the New York Police Department on the Panther headquarters. So four of the members were placed on the tier I was on. And so I had an opportunity to meet them and talk with them. And, you know, they started holding political classes and stuff. And, you know, I was listening to what they were saying, but I wasn't hearing. I wasn't understanding, you know, the concept of social struggle and revolution and self-determination and some of the things that they were talking about. And eventually I read a book that a cellmate of mine had called A Different Drummer. It was a fictional piece of work based upon the Great Migration of African Americans from the southern part of the country to the east and west and north, believing that things were better. And so from that point on, I began to not just listen, but hear what they were saying and understand. And I guess you could say that was the first time that I had what was called a political awakening, a raising of the level of consciousness until, you know, I began to understand that, you know, my being in prison was not because of me, but it was because of the racist economic, political, and social policies of America that determined in my generation that one out of every four African Americans would wind up in prison. And so, you know, of course, that was a rude awakening for me, and it instilled in me something that I had never really thought about, you know, a sense of pride, a sense of self-worth, a sense of purpose and direction that I had never known before, never had any experience with.
I think it's important for listeners to understand that while you were in New York, you weren't going by Albert Woodfox. You were incarcerated under a different name that you had given him. But ultimately, the fingerprints came back and they figured out who you were.
Yeah, I was using the alias Charles Harris. And once they fingerprint you know it's on them. So after going to trial and being found not guilty, I spent, you know, almost 2 years fighting extradition back to Louisiana. You know.
And ultimately you lost that fight and ended back at Angola. You are listening to Upfront. I am in conversation with Albert Woodfox about his new book, Solitary, which chronicles the 40 years he spent in solitary confinement, mostly at Angola Prison in Louisiana. So you're back at Angola, but now you are back at Angola with the political education of the party as your foundation, which you start to share inside of the prison. How did prison officials react to that?
Well, it was strange because, first of all, I didn't expect to last in population that long. And you know, I figured as soon as they got word that I was, you know, talking about social struggle and trying to organize guys, trying to bridge the gap between the whites and black prisoners, because Angola was a segregated prison at that time. And just like society, the white prisoners enjoyed the privileges and benefits of their skin color, whereas the blacks mostly had the lowest jobs, from being in working in the field to being like dormitory orderlies or working in a dining hall 16 hours a day or 7 days a week, those kind of jobs. And so there was, you know, prison corruption going on from the administration all down to the security staff. There was a brutal inmate guard system at play in which the other inmates were given pretty much the same power as the security officers, who were referred to as free men at the time, or free man. And so, you know, it was against this backdrop. There was an active sex slave market going on. And so it was against these conditions that I began to try to raise the level of consciousness of the prisoners who were victims of it and organize them into an effective resistance against those. And as a result of that, a correctional officer by the name of Brent Miller was found stabbed to death in one of the living units, Pine One. And I automatically became the number one suspect. And, you know, I was the first guy locked up for investigation. And for the next 44 years and 10 months, I lived in solitary confinement.
Albert, I mean, there's a lot I want to talk about, but you just ended on that note. 44 years, you ended up in solitary confinement, and we'll get into the way in which the state tried to frame you and Herman. But a lot of folks, you know, they talk about they couldn't, you know, the 24 hours in solitary confinement, and they started to, you know, detach and feel, you know, that they were not as mentally stable. How did you endure 44 years of solitary confinement?
You know, I mean, I've been asked that question probably more than any other question since I've been free now, a little over 3 years. I think it, you know, in hindsight, it all started with my mom. You know, I realized that the things I rebelled against, my mom was trying to teach me about, you know, give me a sense of self-worth, teach me the principles of dignity, pride, self-respect, and hard work, the benefits of working for, you know, what you wanted, And, you know, things that I as a teenager, I rebel against. You know, there's a poem in my book, in the beginning of the book called Echoes. You know, I think it pretty much describes my relationship with my mom, you know. And the reason I call it Echoes is because of my joining the party, because of being self-educated, because of my level of consciousness, both personal and political, being raised, because of my commitment to social struggle, I began to realize, you know, that even though my mom was functionally illiterate, she was one of the wisest and strongest people I had ever known. And the strength that was the foundation of me surviving prison in general and solitary and individually was because of those things. The things she's examples, you know, she didn't have the education. We didn't sit down and have these conversations, but by example, the way she was, the things she did to make sure we had a roof over our head and clothes and food, and if we got sick, to be able to go to the doctor, and just some of her wisdom, you know, some of the things she used to say about things I did or things that were going on in the neighborhood or in society.
Echoes. Echoes of wisdom I often hear, a mother's strength softly in my ears. Echoes of womanhood shining so bright, echoes of mother within darkest night. Echoes of wisdoms on my mother's lips, too young to understand it was in a gentle kiss. Echoes of love and echoes of fear, arrogance of manhood wouldn't let me hear. Echoes of heartache I still hold close as I mourn the loss of my one true hero. Echoes from a mother's womb, heartbeats held so dear, life begins with my first tears. Echoes of footsteps taken in the past, echoes of manhood standing in a looking glass. Echoes of motherhood gentle and near, echoes of a lost mother I will always hear. Albert Woodfox, 1995.
I realized that as I began to re-educate myself and began to become more knowledgeable about the mechanics of a society, I began to have this familiarity, you know, like I've heard this before, I've seen this. And a lot of times when I ran into complex situations, I would always refer back, or I could hear, you know, things my mom used to say about situations going on in the neighborhood and in society as a whole. And so that became like, and still is, you know, my foundation in which everything else stands on.
It's the voice of Albert Woodfox. He served the longest period of solitary confinement in U.S. prison history, more than 40 years in Angola State Prison in Louisiana. He was released in 2016. He's discussing his new memoir, Solitary, with Kat Brooks, and they'll continue the conversation when we return.